Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and we're about to have a lot of fun because I have Aisha Wax on Zoom. Hey, Aisha.
Hi. So excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I feel like, I could be wrong, but I feel like we talked about recording this podcast for a long time, and schedules are tough.
Yes.
And congratulations. I know one reason why you had to say, Jeff, I can't record this podcast for a while is you got married.
I did. I got married in April. It was awesome. Highly recommend.
Congratulations. Yeah, I liked it so much I did it twice. But we are here. We are finally on. I think this is our first Zoom since Film Invasion Los Angeles 2020. I think we did a Q&A Zoom.
We did.
Like one and a half.
Yes.
Because you were on the first night, as people might recall. Film Invasion Los Angeles was in June of 2020, which means you made your film, you completed it, you submitted it to festivals. Film Invasion's deadline was March 15th, and people might remember March 15th, 2020 was literally the day everything changed. Like, everyone submitted to that festival thinking nothing was unusual. There was something weird going on cruise ships, maybe.
Yeah.
And then odds are, it'd be embarrassing if I looked at it, but I bet there's an email from the festival to everyone who submitted saying, you know, we're going to keep our eyes on this, but we'll probably be in the theater in June because, you know, I'm not going to call out anybody, but there were certain presidents saying that, you know, it would be like 12 people and then end. So not that I believed that at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a different, it feels like a lifetime ago, to be honest.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, you had the least fortunate timing of having, I'm sure everyone I ever knew always avoided virtual festivals, right? You're like, I'm only going to submit to a film festival if it's an actual film festival. If they do an online thing, forget it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, every festival became virtual for about a year and a half.
Yeah, this was my first short film and my first experience. And I, through the whole festival process, only went to one in-person festival last September. So it was definitely a weird experience because it was like, it felt like I was doing well, but I also never went anywhere or met anybody. I mean, I met some people through Film Invasion, but like, I will say you did do the best job with facilitating like meet and greets and Zooms. And I feel like anybody who I met through the festival circuit, I met through Film Invasion. But the rest of the festivals that I did, I didn't go to anything. And like, it was all from my living room. So it was like a very anticlimactic experience. Like last September, I did a festival in Austin and I finally got to see my film on the big screen, and it was really exciting. And it was like 2 years in the making, but it was a very strange experience to be like, I feel like this is doing well, but who knows? I have not been anywhere.
and I can tell you with, as someone who is programmed, I think my 16th festival will be in November. And had we just been in the theater like normal, you're LA based, so you actually would have been at Film Invasion LA, and you would have heard a full, you know, we normally get 40, 50, we fill up the house close to it. And you would have got to hear people laugh because your film, by the way, did I name it Grief Vigilantes? I think I jumped into the introduction and I didn't say Grief Vigilantes is the name of the film.
Yes.
And at Film Invasion Los Angeles, you got two awards. You got Outstanding Short Film Comedy and Outstanding Acting by a Cast, which anyone who's seen the film, that was, you ran away with those because it is a great cast and it is such a funny film. And comedy in a theater with other humans, it's the best. They're actually, then comes horror, like it's nice to be scared with other people, but drama, you don't really need to be in a theater with other people for a drama like you do comedy.
I agree completely. And yeah, it is, I feel like so fortunate that I got to see it once, but that I got to have that, and it got into so many festivals. And I did get super lucky with my cast. They're all friends and they are all amazing actresses. And I just asked them to do it because I knew they were the best. So
makes sense. And yeah, you're doing the right thing when you're, that's, I think the quote by Spike Lee, like someone said, you always cast your friends. And he said, my friends are great actors.
Yeah. I try to surround I've been in the comedy scene in LA for 13, 14 years. So I have been around the block at the Groundlings and at UCB. And I know a lot of people who are just like amazing comedians. And like, I feel like they always say it, but it's true. Like, it's much harder to do comedy than it is to do drama. So when you find good comedic actors, you're like, well, I know they can do anything.
And yeah, because comedians can do, if there's some serious moments in a comedy, your funny people can do it. If there's a funny moment in a drama, sometimes it's tough. But okay, you brought in the perfect topic, which is that you were around the LA comedy scene for a decade and a half. But you want to go back, like, when did you first get interested in performing or writing? Were you a theater kid?
Yes. So I was a big musical theater kid. I am from LA. I'm from the Valley. I went to a Jewish day school, Milken Community High School, and I did theater there. And then in college, I went to UC Irvine and did theater and musical theater and went and studied abroad in Italy and studied Commedia dell'arte and came back to LA and just started doing a ton of sketch comedy and a ton of improv and went through the whole program at the Groundlings and at the Upright Citizens Brigade and at Improv Olympic, which is no longer here. If you do comedy long enough, I'm sure this is the same for festivals. Like, you live to see festivals and comedy theaters die and then maybe be reborn, or like, it's a very interesting circular process. So I used to perform a lot at Improv Olympic, which is no more. Now there's the PAC Theater, which I've also performed at. And I just love making things. I love performing. I love writing. I love directing. I like making stories.
Right. So all along, there was a comedic focus, although musical theater was a first love.
Yes.
But you transitioned to comedy like high school, college?
College. I feel like, so in college, I was doing musicals, but I was always getting like the funny part. And I was like, I think that I should cut out the musical part. And I love comedy. I love things that make people laugh. And I have been doing that and writing at the same time. And then I've been directing more seriously for the last 5 years.
And it makes a lot of sense because musical theater, all you can do is keep auditioning and keep trying, plugging away. And, you know, you can write a musical and nothing will ever happen. But if you get interested in your comedic side, you can do sketch this weekend, or, you know, you can hit open mics and pretend to be a comedy team. Like, there's a lot more opportunity. Comedy is all about the creators who perform their own creation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very empowering. I was in a sketch group for 5 years after college. I had a writing partner for another 5 years. It's like all these different relationships, and you kind of learn about yourself you're like coming to know yourself, your voice as a performer and as a person at the same time, which is very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And you named all the places. Yeah. I remember Improv Olympic, the location that is now UCB, right? So the Franklin one was Improv Olympic when I used to go there.
Oh, really?
And then it just was shut down for a while. And actually, then I was out of touch, and, you know, all my friends and I were too old to be hip anymore. And then I hear about UCB and I'm like, what's UCB?
Yeah.
Something out of New York. And then I drive by Franklin. I'm like, oh, that was Improv Olympic like 10 years ago.
That's so funny. Yeah. And now UCB closed down during the pandemic, and then now it's coming back. So it's like this very, like, you know, you live long enough type of thing, you're going to see a theater close down,
for
or reopen. And yeah, I feel like I learned a lot about life and a lot about friendship and a lot about myself from doing comedy so long.
And you did full programs at Groundlings and UCB, yes, which I also believe builds a toughness.
Yes. Yes. It definitely builds a toughness. If you're lucky, you get really good teachers. I had Karen Murayama at the Groundlings, who's been teaching there for a while, and she's amazing and she's very tough. But I think it teaches you structure, and it gives you a thick skin, and it kind of gives you the persistence that you need. So, and being okay, I think when I did the advanced lab at the Groundlings, you're rewriting things constantly. And I also wrote for the CBS Diversity Showcase, and like you're rewriting things up until the last minute, and there's always a better joke. And so it's much easier to get less attached to your work. And it gives you, you know when something is right and you know when something is wrong intrinsically.
Because I can't help, and no offense to all the screenwriters out there who never leave home, but I've known for decades, you will meet people and they're writers and they never leave home, and they're precious about every word, and they're precious about, you know, all kinds of things. And that's when I said toughness, I didn't, you know, mean anything negative at all. I meant that like you learn the value in not being precious.
Yeah, I think that's a hard thing to learn for. I think a lot for dramatic writers, it's very difficult. For some comedy writers too, but you just get used to letting go a lot, and which is hard for all of us in our lives in general. But I do feel like with my work, I'm able to let go of it, or like sometimes put something down and pick it back up, or shoot something. You know, I talk to a lot of people who are doing shorts, and like making sure that it's okay if it's imperfect. It's never going to be perfect. The fact that you made it is enough.
Yeah. And being open to handing it off to others, whether it's a director or a cast. I mean, obviously Grief Vigilantes, you chose a cast who you knew and trusted, but obviously when you hand it off to people, yeah, nothing's worse than a director who says, no, go back to the script. What you just added, I don't want. Like, that person added something.
Yeah.
You should be open to it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I trust that if I have a good actor, they're just only going to improve upon. They're probably smarter than I am. So I wouldn't say
they're smarter than you, but.
No, but I mean.
Two great minds working together is one great mind better than one great mind working alone. And for those who are wondering, Zoom just froze, so I'm going to talk a little while I wait for. Okay, so now you're unfrozen.
Great.
We got to live with Zoom.
Yeah. But it is definitely like, I like working with actors who I trust. I don't like over directing, and I think it's like being clear with someone, but trusting that they will get you there. And if they won't, I've dealt with that too. Less in my own personal short films that I've made and sketches, but more in theater work, and it's hard. And that is a different kind of challenge. And that is about getting really weird and experimental. So that's
Well, and so now I'm curious, obviously there was a lot of stage work because Groundlings and UCB and IO are all stage oriented. So did you start acting in some short films or performing, and that got you interested in film, or did you just, or is it writing and just making the choice to direct your own?
I think it was writing and directing my own. I also was directing for the Braid Theater. They have a fellowship, and I did their fellowship for directing, and it was kind of had shepherded. I had done some directing in my 20s. I directed people's sketches. I directed one-person shows for people because I'd done a one-person show. So I'd had my hands kind of in the pot before, and then I just kind of jumped in, I guess, kind of, you know, I felt like I had the experience to back me up, even if I didn't have necessarily the, cinematographer experience that certain, I think like directing is like very technical and very people oriented. So I have the people skills and I'm building up the lighting skills. I did take lighting design in college, so I have that one course to go off of.
Oh, excellent. And I have to say, I mean, I don't know why I feel the need to add this, but yeah, when you talked about, I think a lot of the public, obviously people in comedy or in theater know it, but there's so many people make the assumption that like a one person show is just that person. And they don't even think about the fact that there's a director and maybe a producer and people giving that person feedback and stage directions, all kinds of back and forth in the creative process. It's not just one person by themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I did it, when I was like 23, I taught Hebrew school and I wrote a one woman show about my horrible experience teaching Hebrew school called Hebrew School Horror. And I had director Eliza Skinner, who's a stand-up, directing me, and she helped me. It wasn't just like, you know, where to walk, but it was honing the performance and also honing the writing. So I think the nice thing about coming from the comedy world is you kind of learn how to do everything. And you get that confidence that even if it's not perfect, it's going to be okay.
You know, I almost want to shift, just react to the words Hebrew school. I can't imagine what you went through. I was probably one of those nightmare kids who didn't want to be there. It's tough.
I think, you know, it's funny. I had a lot of experience. So I taught Hebrew school for 10 years as somebody in LA who's Jewish. It's a great job to have if you are a writer or performer. I could go on commercial auditions during the day and teach Hebrew school at night. And I worked at about 5 different synagogues in Los Angeles. So I had a lot of different experiences. I think the hardest part, which was what my show was about, was when I started, I was 22 and I was in charge of 12-year-olds, and like the maturity gap wasn't there. Like I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't really consider myself an adult. And here I am being in charge of all of these kids and like teaching them about morals and like prayer. And I felt like such an imposter. And by the end, I was like, no, I'm an adult. I know what I'm doing. I'm fine.
You know, I get that. I mean, and my apologies to the non-Jewish world, but 12 is tough because they're like really close to their bar bat mitzvah and you're 22. So yeah, you're closer in age to them than you are to the parents.
For sure. Yeah. It was a very strange, like, especially when I started the first 2 years, I felt completely out of my element. And I taught 6th grade, so they were like 11. So they were just starting to be jerks. And I taught them both Hebrew and I taught them like, I would teach like Jewish life cycles or like, you know, different Jewish perspectives. And the kids are, you know, really awful as you are. Some were not. I think I actually did get to teach sketch to kids who are in 7th and 8th grade when I was like 25, 26. And that was awesome. And they really liked doing that. And, I feel like I was okay with, I think it's really hard to make kids upset and to be a voice of authority when you're 22. Like you don't even know who you are. Like I felt like such an imposter, whereas like, you know, I was going to teach Hebrew school and then I would like go to an open mic and then go to a sketch show and then go get drunk and then start and then go on a weird date. And so I felt like this, like my life was so felt insane. Like I was like 5 different people. And then I would walk into Hebrew school and have to be like, you know, an adult, the authority on all of these kids. And it was really hard for me. I think that it took me a long time to be able to own that. I made a lot of kids cry before I was able to be like, okay, this is fine.
I can't help but observe, though, that imposter syndrome and overcoming it is incredibly good training for the entertainment industry, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Everybody feels that.
Well, it's funny. I feel like dealing with kids for so long has taught me how to deal with adults. I think that it's really difficult and you learn. And I used to also give, I at the same time also worked at Tree People. So I used to give nature tours to little kids. So I was working with new kids all the time. And it's very much, the nice thing was when you like left work, you didn't have children. So you didn't hate any, like you didn't hate the people around you versus my friends who worked at like a restaurant who were like, oh, people are terrible. I would just be like, oh, children are terrible, but I don't have children. So I'm going to go home and be fine. But the cool thing about it is that you're like, okay, they just want to feel heard. They just want to feel respected. These kids like sometimes need to be put in line and sometimes need someone to tell them what to do. And you learn how to do that. And then when you're dealing with an adult, you're like, okay, these people need to be told what to do. These people need to feel respected. It's the same thing for no matter how old somebody is.
It is. And there's that Alfred Hitchcock quote that actors are like children that a lot of people get angry about. But I think you can interpret that differently, that actors are so vulnerable.
Yeah.
The acting on film, they need a director to act as a parent, to act, to provide what they need when they need it. Because good parenting isn't controlling your kid. Good parenting is being there when they need it, letting them do their own thing when that's right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's totally that. It's totally, it's about trust and it's about respect, and working with kids is about that too. And, being, yeah, like in terms of letting go of, you're not going to be right all the time. You're going to make mistakes and sometimes they're going to be upset and you can't control that. And it's, I guess, learning how to be an adult is the same as learning how to be a director.
Well, and I don't want to sound like the old man all the time, but I think we all learn when you're in your 20s, you can't believe how little you knew in your teens. And when you're in your 30s, you look back on your 20s, 40s. I swear, at your 50s, you look back on your 40s, 60s. I don't think it's till your 70s that you finally start going, I used to be sharper. Like we just keep learning more and more.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And I just have to say that I'm amazed I never met you before, because I grew up in Studio City, so I lived near the Tree People place my whole life. And now you know from when you came here to get your trophy for Grief Vigilantes, what am I, 4 minutes from Millikan?
Yeah.
Academy? Like your high school, I could walk to it.
You could, yeah. Yeah.
It's just kind of funny coincidences. And I will share the coincidence that the best man at your wedding was on this podcast I recorded yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so this is a weird, the simulation we live in is like, you know, it's the cat is, it's weird. There's a weird glitch in the matrix right here.
I feel like LA is kind of a small town, and like, people who are Jewish in LA, it's even more of a small town. So
yeah. When you're born and grow up here, it's so different than the people who move here.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I love, it's funny because, you know, I feel like a lot of people have a very mixed relationship where they're from, but I love Los Angeles. I feel like it's so multifaceted, and every neighborhood has its own character and it's like growing and changing. And I'm lucky that I've gotten to live here.
And I imagine you had the same experience I did growing up in the San Fernando Valley, which was, there was never a time when my group of friends, close friends, were not mixed of many, many races and cultures.
Actually, no, because I went to a Jewish.
Oh, you went to all Jewish schools, right?
Yeah. So most of my friends for growing up were all Jewish. So I lived in like a monoculture of a high school experience. And then in college, I went to a state school. And so that was a much more mixed and diverse experience. And ever since then, and I really craved that afterwards. But for my mom, it was super important for me to have this Jewish education. And so she sent me to Milken, and it was something that she had wanted that she wasn't able to have growing up. So yeah, I had a very different experience. My husband is actually from Los Angeles too, and he has a very multifaceted group of friends, but no, my group of friends is very specific, but I I'm still incredibly close with all of them. So I think that that's also very lucky. And a lot of them are still here. So it's very nice.
That is another nice thing about growing up in LA is most of your friends don't leave. Actually, my closest friend in the world left. He went up to Vancouver. But otherwise, there's not many other places you can move to. My friends who moved to Chicago eventually came back because they couldn't take the winters. And people who moved to New York or Boston come back because in the end, it's hard to beat LA.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, especially if you're in entertainment, there's very few places for you to go. So yeah, I've been really lucky, and I do know this city very differently than I did as a kid. I felt very siloed in the valley, and like LA, it is a landscape has really changed. Like I now live in Eagle Rock. We just moved here, but I'd never been here as a kid. I had never been to like Echo Park. It was like after the LA riots, and I feel like my parents were very sheltering and didn't take me to that part of town. And it's amazing. Like I lived in Koreatown. I've lived in West Hollywood. I think Los Angeles is just such a cool place to live.
It is. It is. All right. So you're writing. We'll get you back in the theater. So you're at these theaters and you're doing the programs. Was there anything specific that led to you deciding to make a film?
I think I was looking for kind of like a different kind of calling card for my writing. I'd written a lot of sketches. I'd written a lot of I'd written a couple screenplays, and I wanted a challenge. And so I was like, I want to do a short film. And this was right after my dad died. So it felt like a new focus, and it felt like something to put my effort into. And it was based on this grief group that I had been in that was really inspiring. And I was messaging them earlier tonight. And so, yeah, I wanted to translate that. And I think too, you know, before my dad died, I had spent a lot of time writing. I'd written for myself, but I'd also written in partnerships or in groups. And this was a time where I was coming back to writing with myself. And so I wanted to do a project for myself. And writing in a partnership is wonderful, but it is like a marriage. And when it ends, it can make you feel like you don't know who you are anymore on your own. So this was kind of a way for me to feel like I could restore who I was and who I was as a creator.
Yeah. And your dad passing, were you considering film before? I'm sorry if you sort of answered it, but were you considering film and then that happened, or did that happen? And then when you decided to write about it, it felt like film was the right way.
Yeah. So I think when he had passed, like I was taking care of him the year before, and I was doing sketch still, and I had just finished the CBS showcase writing for it. So I'd done a lot of writing, and I was doing a fair amount of stand-up at the time. And then when he passed, I took a big break because I didn't have any. I did try to go back to stand-up like immediately. And I was immediately like, this was a horrible mistake. I don't want to do this. Because people would be like, I haven't seen you in a couple of months. And I'd be like, my dad died.
And you said you did some caretaking.
I did. Before. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'll drop the another connection we have, which is when we first tried to do our first podcast or our first Q&A about Grief Vigilantes, it was the evening that morning I had buried my father.
Yeah.
And that had involved a solid 3 years of caretaking due to dementia.
Ugh, that's awful.
And my mom just being incapable So it was an insanely difficult time. And so, yeah, I totally understand what you mean. Like when somebody says, when you've done caretaking for a parent, it's just, it matures you and changes you.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of this happened, like, I had like just turned 30. And so I was like, kind of now like an adult without my dad and figuring it out. And yeah, I'd been taking care of him on and off for like 2 years. It was kind of a roller coaster because he would get sick and then he would get better and then he was fine. He had lung cancer, and he didn't die of lung cancer. He died of complications from like his body breaking down in other ways. So it was
medications, what? Maybe sometimes the medications.
He had like, what's it called? Blood clots. So, and like, that was a big factor in it. His body was just tired, I feel like, at that point. But yeah, after that ended, I was like, I want to try something new. And that's when I was like, I would like to try doing film.
And then Grief Vigilantes was the first thing you wrote.
Yes.
And I guess I'll just ask the obvious question for the, well, by the way, is there somewhere where people can watch it yet?
Not yet. Soon. I'm still working on it.
Soon. It won't be in the Discovery Indie Film TV series, but anytime there's a place, you could just let me know.
And
we'll put a link in the show notes because people should see it. But I think obviously by the fact that it won Outstanding Short Film Comedy, people know that it's and the title Grief Vigilantes. I think I won't give anything away if I ask the question, did you deal with people who are insensitive to the loss?
Yes, you deal with a lot of, and I'm sure you've dealt with this too. I think that people are really uncomfortable with death and like sadness and don't know how to deal with you. And like, you feel apologetic to them about telling your sad story. So grief is incredibly lonely. So when someone is insensitive, it feels uncomfortable. I remember I went back to work and all these people were hugging me, which was almost worse. And this one woman who was older gave me a hug and went, "You'll never be the same." And I was like, "Oh my God." Like, this is a Monday after I come back to work. And I was just like, well, I didn't need to hear that. It's probably true. I mean,
even if it's true, oh my God.
So yeah. And I had dealt with, at the time, an insensitive boss. Like, some of the story is based around what happened to me, around my boss at the time, who was being insensitive about my dad. And so you get really angry when you're going through grief, and you think through a lot of like really violent scenarios that you're not going to actually do. And when you're in a grief group, you have people who support you in your anger. So I just took it to the next extreme.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the largest fallacies about grief is this stupid seven stages thing, because you experience all seven stages at all times, various times throughout the day. It's not once you're done with anger, you move on to something else. No, it's, you can be angry today, you can be sorrowful tomorrow, you can be angry again, then you'll be bargaining. It's all at once. I can't believe our culture has bought into some ridiculous story about grief, but I guess it's because our culture can't deal with death at all.
I think it's easier. I think it's like, there's so many unknowns, and I think it's scary. And like, I try to be empathetic to people who were really distant during that time. Now, I couldn't at the time. Like, I had friends who like disappeared or who came, but I mean, most of my friends were fine, but I think that there were a lot of people who were really uncomfortable. I remember going to lunch with someone and they were like, "I was waiting for you to reach out to me." And I went, "I would have never reached out to you. Like, I was tired. I had stuff to do." Like, I think the, like you're saying, like, it's really uncomfortable. And we don't a lot of times talk about all of the like, labor that's involved afterwards. Like, I had to clean out my dad's house. Like, you have to, figure out what to do with all their bills. And like, I'll give this example. This is like a crazy story that has, so my dad had an iPad that I have, and I wanted to reset it, and I don't have his password. I will never have his password. And, I went to the Apple store and they were like, well, you need his password. And I would be like, okay, well, I don't have it. So then I, like, 6 months would go by, and then I'd come back a year later and they'd be like, you don't have his password. There's nothing we can do. Or like, you have to keep calling this one number. So then I do that for a week and then I get tired and then I wouldn't do it. So I went back again. This was in November. And I said, this is my dad's iPad. It's almost 5 years old at this point. And they were like, you have to go to a judge who has to rule that this is your dad's iPad. You have to get a court order because of privacy laws, then we will unlock it. Anyway, that's the kind of bullshit that you deal with when someone dies that nobody is going to warn you about.
Yeah. And oh, yeah. Ridiculous. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so the script was born from everything you went through. But specifically, you also were very smart and went to a grief group.
Yeah. I had one of my dad's friends recommended our house, which is in LA, and they were amazing. They actually, we filmed there for free. They were super supportive, and I was incredibly lucky. I met an amazing group of women, and yeah, I would highly recommend going to a grief group if you can. I think I got lucky that my dad passed away before the pandemic, so we all met in person, which makes a large difference. I think it's really hard over Zoom. I actually, the lead actress in my film, her mom passed away last year, and she went to a grief group over Zoom and was saying how difficult it was because it's not quite the same.
Yeah, it's not. Actually, my uncle lost his wife of 60 plus years during the pandemic, but he found a grief group that always met at a park.
Oh, that's nice.
And so they just wore masks at a park outdoors.
That's better.
And now he's partnered with one of those ladies he met.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, what can you do? I guess, you know, in your 80s, well, anyway. So the script came naturally. It was a quick, was it obviously, this is a very packed question. My apologies for the lameness of the question, but was it liberating and,
yeah, it was really nice to write. And like a lot of it was pulled from my own experience. And we shot in places. We shot at my office that I work at, where my boss was not nice to me. We shot at our house where I went to grief group. I wrote it once. And then I had a draft. I got notes from a friend. Then a friend of mine would have these like salons, and I brought it up and got notes on that, revised it. And then started getting ready to shoot it, found my producers, and just went ahead with it. So I think I only did like two revisions because I felt good about it. And I have done a lot of sketch comedy and a lot of film sketch comedy. So I have the experience of like collaborating and getting people together. And so I was like, okay, let's make this happen. And I got really lucky in that I got all my locations for free. Where they're sitting and crying on the bench is where I used to sit and cry on the bench too. I didn't have a permit, but we just shot there. And yeah, it was really liberating to get to write it all down and to have it connect people and to talk about grief and to have something that I know my dad would be really proud of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it makes sense that you were able to shoot it that way and to trust not an early draft, but you also probably knew the people you're bringing in. You sort of know how to, when you do sketch, you know how to punch things up in the moment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I just trusted that they would like, if they needed to improvise, they would. They're all such awesome actresses. I love the team I assembled. It just felt, yeah, it all came together really easily.
Yeah, and really, I think it's the tone, and the tone comes from the writer-director, but the tone of it is so refreshing and enjoyable that you did actually make a very enjoyable film about a very difficult subject.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I kind of wanted to talk about how, like, grief is, as you were saying, it's like funny sometimes. You laugh at funerals. There's a lightness to it as well. And even, you know, we're in Los Angeles, and when you're grieving, it's still sunny outside. So you can't pretend that the colors are less bright just because you're sad. They're still bright. You're just sad.
No. And yeah, grief is, whether you're in LA or not, those people, especially people who have been in your life forever, like a parent or a best friend, it is, you just keep bringing them up for forever.
Yeah.
Like, they're still a part of us.
Oh, for sure.
And it's funny. I'm less sad. My best friend of 40 years died of COVID.
I'm so sorry.
The guy who moved to Vancouver, and this guy and I were the high school trio. And now we're a duo. COVID got him in March of 2020. Wow. So yeah, before anyone really knew to look out for it, he had comorbidities. He had had Hodgkin's lymphoma at age 12.
Oh my God.
So he was one of those people whose immune system just wasn't going to take it. So, and now I can just say, like, you know, well, whatever I said to the other guy in the trio, like, you know, you have to come down to LA for this thing for me, because you're the only friend I have left. But like, I say it in a funny way to me, but
yeah, I get what you're saying. And that's really hard. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, I am very sorry for your loss. You lost your father at the age you're not supposed to lose parents yet.
Yeah, I think it was a very strange experience, but unfortunately, like, yeah, losses comes for us all at weird times. So
yeah, there's no good time for it.
No. But yeah, I do feel him all the time. My dad and I used to do yoga all the time together, and I went to a yoga class this afternoon, and I could feel his presence, and I think about him every time I do yoga, and it makes me happy. So, yeah, I think those people and those experiences are always with you.
Yeah. I'll push back to the movie. So I'm the one who like got more emo there, but
that's fine.
Yeah, no, I know it's impossible to discuss your work without like talking about, I'm sure that would be wonderful for you. Yeah. Hopefully. Well, you got to see it at a live festival, but do people come up to you afterwards and say like it brought something out of me?
Yeah, I think I've talked to a lot of people who've lost someone who really appreciate it. I think it can, and it's fun and poignant for those who haven't lost someone. So yeah, but a lot of it, I didn't, you know, again, this was such a weird experience. It happened in a bubble. So like, I didn't have that experience of being at a festival and like having the audience reaction. It was like the opposite of all of my comedy experiences, where like I'd be on stage and I'd leave and I'd know how it went. I feel really good about it. And I know that the people I never had that. I only once had that experience with an audience.
Yeah, just one. I mean, yeah, and I'm sure awards are nice.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as sitting in the theater and hearing the laughs and hearing the bits work and the beats work.
It's different, but I feel like, you know, I can't complain. I had a really good COVID. I got two new cats. I hung out with my husband. I got to win awards from the comfort of my couch. So it was kind of wonderful in itself.
Absolutely. All right. So did it give you the taste for directing film?
Yeah. Yeah. I just finished my next short film. So I'm starting on that festival circuit, it's gotten into three festivals so far.
Congrats. That sounds great.
Thank you.
And just more and more, is it going to be a focus? Have you, now that everyone's been, or not everyone's been back, well, what a funny statement, everyone's been vaccinated. No, not everyone's been vaccinated, but we're kind of over it anyway. Like, have you gone back to the theater world at all?
So throughout pandemic, I was doing a lot of work with The Braid, which used to be the Jewish Women's Theater, and I was directing a lot of their Zoom shows. So I had been doing that up until, and then I did a web series for them up until January. So yes and no, it was still film, but also theater. So
and remote still.
Yeah.
Like you've become a Zoom expert.
I have. I can tell. I know what to do. And so I've had a little bit of both, but I love film. I love theater. I love making art. And I love comedy. So I'm just going to keep doing it.
And I guess the question I'm trying to get at is like, are you going to jump back on stage for sketch or anything?
Yes, probably.
You've been so busy.
Well, I do a monthly show at this venue called The Clubhouse with two other female comedians. It's called Soft Skills, and it's a variety show. The second Saturday at 10 p.m. every month. And so I do characters and stand-up and storytelling, and that's definitely been scratching that itch. We've been doing it since March.
Oh, great. So, yeah, and that's once a month you're doing it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. You're keeping your muscles. It's like going to the gym.
Exactly.
Wonderful. And bigger film plans? Like, are you thinking features or thinking?
I am. It feels like a big, I like to do things that scare me. That's how I started doing stand-up. And this kind of scared, doing a short film also kind of scared me. So I'd like to do a feature at some point. I'm writing a feature right now. But that's a whole other animal that requires some fundraising. So we'll see. I love TV too. I would love to like direct for TV or direct for commercials. I just like all of it.
And still deeply rooted in comedy or?
Yeah. Although I'm writing like a horror comedy, but yeah, I did for The Braid, I did a lot of drama. I did a lot of dramatic pieces over the last 2 years. So I guess, you know, the best dramatic pieces have a little bit of lightness to them too. They're not just like maudlin heavy. Being able to bring myself to whatever piece I'm doing next, which will always have a little bit of comedy in it.
Well, I think you're onto something with horror comedy because besides the fact that horror might be the most commercial of genres, I've got a theory that I can't stop repeating, which is that the scare and the laugh are special, that they're both involuntary and they just go together so well in a film. I think all the best horror films have laughs in them.
I agree.
Because otherwise it just becomes like too intense.
Yeah.
And, you know, Scream is actually really scary, but it's also really funny at times.
Exactly. Yeah. I love a horror comedy. They're good and they have a lot to say usually. So I'm all about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that the feature or is that?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my feature I'm working on.
All right. Well, it should be a little easier to raise money for a horror. I know it's. I don't know what kind of way I can prevent that from being a hex, but
that's okay. You know what? I've also had lots of things where I've let go of projects. They've come back into my life. You never know, like the right things happen at the right time project wise. And sometimes it's not that right time and you put it down for 5 years and then it's time to do it. So, I'm very much all about being open to like what the spirit of like the artistic process is telling me to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we discussed before we started recording, by being multifaceted, by having directing, film directing, stage directing, writing for both, performing in both, you are, by not choosing a lane, you're giving yourself more opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And nowadays, heck, the way technology is and the way distribution of entertainment has been completely destroyed and blown up, and no one knows what's going on anymore. That there's no reason why people should limit themselves.
I agree. I think that, you know, you spend a lot, you have a lot of people telling you to choose one thing, but it is like a weird liberal arts degree type of thing of being able to do anything is awesome.
Absolutely. All right. Well, anything you want to add in before we transition? There will be a second pause. I didn't warn you. I'll just say it now while we're recording. But I always stop recording. I let the interview be all about you. And then we'll start recording again for you to answer those four questions.
Okay.
Your favorite films and all that.
Sure.
That'll be like a separate little bit.
Sounds great. You have to remind me what those questions are.
I will. I could do it right now while we're recording. But it's just favorite films, a film that's underrated, a film that's overrated, and a lesser known film that people should seek out.
Okay. 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 And, got it.
Yeah, I know. Because we planned this and rescheduled this so many times, you read that probably 6 months ago or longer. So my apologies for not reminding you.
That's okay. I can come up with stuff on the fly.
Excellent. Yeah, you trained for that.
That's right. That's
you were
right.
A trained improv performer.
Yes.
Excellent. Was there a website or social media handle people
should? Yeah. Aisha Wax and aishawax.com. I'm all around. I make a lot of jokes on Twitter about boba and horny things about the internet. And then on Instagram, it's just pictures of my cats. So I'm sorry in advance.
I will repeat myself. I've said this a few times that, first of all, I'll let people know you spell Aisha, A-Y-S-H-A, wax. They should be able to figure out.
Yes.
And my Instagram is just my fruit and vegetable garden and our guinea pig. Like he's so fucking cute. Like he's a star.
I get it.
And when we have baby birds in the nests under our outdoor speakers, like I said, put tons of pictures of those baby birds. And friends make fun of me. They're like, your life is so exciting. I'm like, it is exciting to have baby birds outside your window. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a dream.
And cats are great.
They are. I mean, yeah. Aren't we lucky we get to have pets? That's how I feel every day.
Yeah, humans. I actually think that every day I pet the little guy and I like, you know, guinea pigs like to be talked to. And so I tell him, you know, this might feel good to you, but there's like chemicals being released in my brain, buddy, because I am touching soft fur and scratching your back. And it just makes us feel better. I think, right? There's tons of studies that like you have lower blood pressure if you have a pet.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you don't like pets, you should probably just like give up. Get out of here.
Definitely. Definitely. It's over.
Yeah, that's a bad person. Is that one of the ways women would judge guys on a date is if the guy doesn't like cats or dogs?
Oh, I don't know. I had like, you know, I used to teach online dating workshops, right?
So I know that you didn't mention it.
Oh, sorry. I used to teach online dating workshops. I would write people's profiles. So I have a myriad ways of judging people. I would say not having a pet or not liking pets is like a yellow flag, not a red flag, not a green flag, but we can get into that another time.
It's been a pleasure. Well, we'll wrap it up because, you know, if we just talk more about pets, I mean, this was supposed to be about the movies anyway. So people should keep their eyes on discoverindiefilm.com because if you go, I think you're going to be episode 310.
Amazing.
So if you go to the website and go to episode 310, of course, with the four questions thing, that means 155 people. But that's still a lot of people. You can get a link to watch Grief Vigilantes, or I'm sure once Grief Vigilantes is viewable for the public online, it'll be at aishawax.com. So,
yes.
People should check that every Thursday at 8 p.m. until it's out.
There we go.
Or every morning. Get up in the morning, get to work.
That seems excessive. I can't make people do that. That's too much.
You know, but they don't know what they're missing is the thing.
That's true.
You know,
that's true. Yeah.
You might as well, you know, be a megalomaniac instead of humble.
I'm both at the same time. So I'm just being both humble and a megalomaniac, but mostly just someone who likes my cats.
Yes. I see what you do with, yeah, you just pet one of them. All right. Well, I will wrap it up. Thank you, Aisha Wax, for doing this interview. And thank you, everyone, for listening.